Good day. Today is Sunday, 5th July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, in my programme yesterday, I discussed the announcement about the fall of Konstantinovka, the fact that the Russian military leadership has reported to Vladimir Putin that the town or city of Konstantinovka in Donbass, the southernmost town of the line of fortified cities that consists of the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka conurbation, has fallen under the control of the Russian army. Now, the fact that some people in the West are unsettled and alarmed by this news is confirmed to me by the very interesting reaction of the media in Britain specifically. Briefly, rather than lead on the fall of Konstantinovka, or at least lead on the Russian claim of the fall of Konstantinovka, there's been a whole succession of different articles, including an article which is the lead article in today's Financial Times about Ukrainian drone attacks on Russia, the difficulties these are allegedly causing to the Russian economy and to the Russian energy system, and squirreled somewhere towards the end of these articles, there is an admission that the Russian military has told Putin that Konstantinovka has fallen. There is no comment at all about the significance of this town. Instead, without exception, every one of these media articles repeat Zelensky's entirely predictable denial that Konstantinovka has indeed fallen under Russian control. So we've had this succession of articles which have appeared right across the media in Britain over the last 24 hours. And, well, all I would say is that, yes, Zelensky has indeed denied that Konstantinovka has fallen. And yes, this denial has also been repeated by the Ukrainian General Staff. If you wish to believe these denials, well, you have some evidence that supports you. Specifically, when the Russian military reported to Putin the day before yesterday that Konstantinovka had been captured, they mentioned that there is still a clearing operation taking place in the city, thereby in effect admitting that there are at least some Ukrainian troops there. But set against that, there is now an increasing volume of video footage from Konstantinovka showing Russian soldiers moving around every part of the city, raising flags or waving flags, Russian flags, in ways that, as far as I'm concerned, put the question of who controls Konstantinovka beyond any serious doubt. The Russians do. The media in the West can look at this footing for themselves. They can, if they have doubts about what is happening in Konstantinovka, follow up and examine this footage and trace it back and do all the usual analysis that all sorts of bloggers and mapping projects do. And, well, if they were to do that, one would perhaps take seriously their any doubts they might have that Konstantinovka is indeed under Russian control. But of course, that is not what they're doing. They're saying, as little about the situation in Konstantinivka as they can get away with. So anyway, I have no doubt myself that Konstantinivka is under Russian control. I already believe this to be the case yesterday. The further video footage that has been pouring out, and there's lots of it now, confirms as much. I think that any refusal to acknowledge this reality is an exercise in denial. That is my view. I would add that the Ukrainians do not have a good record here. They have repeatedly disputed Russian claims that cities that the Russians say they have captured, that the Russians have actually captured. So for weeks they denied that Bakhmut was under Russian control. Last year there was an extraordinary performance about control of the city of Toretsk. The Russians claimed to have captured Toretsk. All sorts of articles appeared in the media in Britain about Toretsk still being under Ukrainian control. None of the serious mapping projects doubts any longer that the Russians are in complete control of Toretsk. The same has happened with Chasiv Yar. I know there are still some brave people who continue to insist that the Ukrainians have a presence in Chasiv Yar. It is correct that until very recently, though not for very much longer, if currently at all, there were Ukrainian troops located immediately to the west of Chasiv Yar. But there's no serious evidence that for any length of time they controlled any part of the town after the Russians announced its capture. But anyway, the Ukrainians did the same with Chasiv Yar. They've done the same, of course, with Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. Until just a few weeks ago, long after the Russians had control of Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, the Ukrainians continued to claim that there was an enclave of Ukrainian troops still holding out in Mirnograd. They don't seem to be doing that any longer. And anyway, this pattern has repeated itself time and again. The Ukrainians always very slow to admit losses of towns or cities. And of course, the most famous recent example is Kupiansk. The Russians claim to have captured Kupiansk in the autumn of 2025. Zelensky then appeared and had himself filmed outside a stela that was actually located 2 kilometres away from Kupiansk. But this was treated as proof that the Ukrainians were in control of Kupiansk. Then there was all sorts of claims and articles and video footage and all sorts of things of that kind circulated for many weeks and many months, suggesting that the Ukrainians were either back in Kupiansk or still in control of Kupiansk, or that they'd won some kind of victory over the Russians in Kupiansk. Again, evidence from Kupiansk recently, as far as I'm concerned, confirms that Kupiansk indeed is under Russian control. So the Ukrainians have a long history of doing this kind of thing. Again, it baffles me why people take this so seriously and assume that these Ukrainian denials are true. I have no doubt at all that the Russians do indeed control Konstantinivka. Anyway, that's not my main point. My main point is the one that I made at the start of this programme. The fact that in Britain, at least, they have been leading with stories about Ukrainian drone strikes inside Russia and continued attacks on refineries, and have avoided discussing the situation in Konstantinivka, highlights the extent to which they have been unnerved and alarmed by the reports and the video footage, of which they must be aware, that Konstantinivka, the gateway to the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation, in other words, to control of the rest of Donbass, has fallen. This contradicts the recent narrative of Ukraine regaining the initiative on the battle lines. It contradicts the narrative of a Russian offensive supposedly at a standstill. It contradicts the narrative of the Russians being on the back foot in the war. And so, since it is contrary to the narrative, the story must be diverted away from the big event of the last 48, 72 hours, the fall of Konstantinivka, back to the topic of Ukraine's drone attacks. And by the way, on this issue, again, Ukraine, I would say, is having difficulties, because as I've discussed in several recent programs now, and as, by the way, you'll find discussed in many other places as well, since mid-June, Ukraine has conducted many big drone strikes against Russia, drone strikes with hundreds of drones. But these strikes don't seem to be having much success. Very few of the drones and the missiles get through. Very few of the drones and the missiles appear to do any serious damage. At least this has been the story over the last 2 weeks. I'm not saying this is going to continue like this indefinitely. I discussed how in the sky, each side constantly maneuvers and works and plans to counter the moves of the others. So it looks as if Russian air defense has become much more effective over the last 2 weeks. The Ukrainians and their Western backers will be trying to find ways to respond to this. And perhaps at some point over the next few days or weeks, they will. My own guess, however, is that with their far greater resources and with a much better and clearer understanding now of the kind of drone offensive that the Ukrainians and their Western backers have been trying to carry out, the Russians are gradually going to upgrade their defences even further. And whatever steps the Ukrainians and the West takes to increase the effectiveness of Ukrainian drone strikes, the Russians will counter that, and counter that to a great extent before it even happens. Even the Ukrainian drone attacks on Crimea and southern Donetsk and Zaporozhye and Kherson regions appear to be losing some of their effectiveness. The Russians appear to have the situation under control. The Novorossiya highway is apparently open for traffic again. From what I understand, the fuel supply situation in Crimea has stabilized. I'm not saying that the problems have gone away or that the situation has been sorted, but it is not as bad or as pressing as it was, let's say, 10 days ago. And, well, that does seem to be the situation at the present time. Anyway, that's the situation in the sky and in Konstantinovka. Now, over the last 24 hours, on the eve of a NATO summit meeting, which is taking place in Ankara, with President Erdogan acting as the host, there have been two telephone conversations, one between Zelensky and Trump, and one between Putin and Trump. And one gets the sense sometimes that there continues to be, at least at some level, some kind of a battle for Donald Trump's ear. I'm not sure that the Russians are as concerned about this as they were a year ago. I think this time last year, the Russians were very keen to try to get Trump to understand what the real situation in the conflict was like, because they still harboured some hopes at that time that Trump might indeed bring to a stop US support for Ukraine. I don't get the sense that the Russians are engaged in that to the same degree anymore. But certainly Zelensky is, especially since the fall of Konstantinovka. And ahead of the NATO summit, where Zelensky wants to meet Trump, and where Zelensky wants more commitments from NATO states for more financial aid for Ukraine. Just recently, just a few months ago, when the European Union announced its 90 billion euro loan, which would provide financial assistance to Ukraine, that was supposed to cover Ukraine's expenses and costs for 2 years. I said that I never believed that would happen. I said at the time that by midsummer, the Ukrainians would be coming back for more. And that is exactly what is taking place. And according to some reports that I've seen, the demands that the Ukrainians are making and which they will be presenting in Ankara are for 70 billion euros, or maybe even dollars more. I'm not sure which it is. So almost as much, well, maybe not quite as much, but still an awful lot on top of the 90 billion euros that was earmarked for them in December 2025 at that European Council meeting which approved the loan for Ukraine, which we've just been talking, I've just been discussing. And of course, this all is happening alongside the financial aid that European countries continue individually to provide. Germany, to my knowledge, provides at least 11 billion euros of financial aid to Ukraine each year, just to say. Britain provides less. Apparently, it's fallen from £5 billion sterling each year to between £3 and £4 billion, but that's still a sizable amount of money. Anyway, all of this money continues to be shoveled at Ukraine. As I said back in December last year that the 90 billion euros wouldn't last beyond the summer, let alone the 2 years that some people have been were talking about. And of course, exactly so it has proved. Again, I find it interesting, I find it strange that no one in the Western media, no Western government is talking about this, there are apparently misgivings on the part of some people in Poland, where they have been involved in a fierce quarrel with the Ukrainians over Zelensky's decision to rebury some Ukrainian nationalist leaders who were deeply, very deeply involved with the Germans during the Second World War, and who the Poles correctly accuse of complicity in massacres of ethnic Poles during the Second World War, and where Zelensky has also renamed certain Ukrainian military units after these same nationalist individuals. Anyway, the Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, has clearly been extremely embarrassed by all of this. He's apparently instructed the Polish delegation, under, I suspect, enormous public pressure, to make no funding commitments on behalf of Poland for Ukraine at the summit meeting in Ankara. And I've heard that in Italy, similar doubts also exist. But to say it straightforwardly, I have absolutely no doubt that Zelensky is going to get the 70 billion euros that he wants. But anyway, Zelensky not only wants, and by the way, needs that 70 billion euros, or is it dollars? He also wants to make absolutely sure that in Ankara, Trump is on side and is not going to push back on any of this. Trump, over the last couple of days, week or so, has again been sounding very critical of NATO, talking about how the European members of NATO were not there for the United States during the Persian Gulf crisis, the conflict with Iran. So Zelensky is anxious to make sure that there is no trouble at all from that quarter, from Donald Trump. I don't think Zelensky expects direct financial transfers from the United States, but he doesn't want Donald Trump to stand in the way of European transfers to Ukraine, which is what we're likely to see. Anyway, that was one conversation. The other conversation was much more interesting, and it was the conversation, another conversation in the series between Putin and Trump, and it took place on the 4th of July, and we have a readout about it from Putin's foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov. Now, this is an interesting commentary because it suggests that the discussion was contentious and didn't go entirely smoothly. The last conversation that Trump and Putin had, which took place on the 12th of June, on the occasion of Russia Day, was by all accounts warm and friendly. This one appears to have been less so. Now, we are not told who initiated the call, though it took place very late at night, 23:55 Moscow time. In other words, 5 minutes before midnight in Moscow. The sense I get, and this may be entirely wrong, is that it was Trump who initiated the call, and that he did so following Putin's message to him, a written message to him, congratulating the American people on the 4th of July, on the 4th of July holiday, and of course on the 250th anniversary of the United States. Putin, by the way, is punctilious about these matters. He always and invariably sends congratulatory messages to major world leaders on these sort of events. And in the fact that he sent such a message, such a written message to Trump, is unsurprising and doesn't tell us very much by itself. But anyway, they went on to have a call, and the call lasted for 85 minutes. So bear in mind, we're talking about a call that began for Putin around midnight Moscow time, and continued until 1:30 in the morning. And anyway, this is how Ushakov describes it. As you know, today, July 4th, the United States marks its national holiday. The day before, President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, sent a letter, a message of greetings to President Trump, expressing confidence that the development of constructive, equally and mutually beneficial ties serves not only the interests of our nation, but the entire international community. As you may remember, on Russia Day, June 12th, the US president sent a message of warm greetings to President Putin. In that message, President Trump paid tribute, and I quote, to the rich history and culture of our country and commended the resilience of the Russian people. Of course, today's conversation between the two heads of state began with President Putin congratulating Trump and the American people on their landmark holiday, and recalling Russia's contribution to the development of American statehood. The Russians talk about this extensively. The historical facts are that during the American War of Independence, Russia, at that time, led by its ruler, the Empress Catherine the Great, pursued an armed neutrality which openly favoured the United States and which essentially blocked Britain from buying materials for its navy from Russia. So the Russians at that time made no secret of their sympathy for the American colonists, who at that time were rebelling against the British Crown. And as is also well known, and as the Russians often like to remind us, during the American Civil War of the 1860s, the Russian government of Tsar Alexander II again strongly backed the United States, even more vigorously, in fact, much more vigorously than during America's War of Independence. And during the American Civil War, or the war between the states, Russian fleets visited the United States as a show of force and as a show of support for the Union in its struggle against the Confederacy, and as a not very veiled warning against Britain, which at that time appeared to be showing sympathy for the Confederacy against the United States. So this history is what Putin is alluding to in this, in, in this part of the discussion. And then Ushakov's commentary continues. The presidents noted the importance of treasuring the historical heritage which our nations share. It was pointed out that our nations will never forget their alliance during the Second World War. The United States is widely celebrating Independence Day. This has been done in style and on a grand scale, as Donald Trump knows how to do it, and our president has mentioned this. Their conversation, the fourth one this year, was not only formal, but also businesslike and constructive. The leaders candidly discussed current issues on the bilateral and international agenda. Incidentally, their conversation lasted nearly an hour and a half, or more precisely, 85 minutes. Now, these are careful words from Ushakov. Notice no words here about the conversation being warm or friendly or sincere. We're told that it was formal, but also businesslike. We're told it was constructive, but the word constructive can mean all kinds of different things. And we're told that the leaders candidly discussed current issues on the bilateral and international agenda, and that the conversation lasted nearly an hour and a half, or more precisely, 85 minutes. Candid discussion, business-like discussion, a discussion lasting 85 minutes. It looks to me as if it was contentious at least some level. Maybe not an out-and-out row, certainly not something like that, but certainly points of disagreement and dispute between the two men, which extended the length of the discussion. At least that is my take of the way that Ushakov describes it. And then we learn what the cause of this dispute might have been. This is going back to Ushakov again. Naturally, the presidents talked about a Ukrainian settlement, including in light of Donald Trump's participation in the upcoming NATO summit in Turkey on July 7th, 8th. The president reaffirmed his readiness to facilitate an early termination of the hostilities and the search for peaceful solutions to the crisis. His special envoys, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, will carry on their mediation efforts and are ready to come to Moscow at our, which is to say Russia's, convenience. The Russian president reaffirmed our commitment to a political and diplomatic settlement of the conflict with due consideration for Russia's known principled approaches. However, Kiev and its Western sponsors, and note the word Western sponsors because that includes the United States, rely on drawing out and even escalating the conflict and terrorizing civilians. Moreover, the European party of war proceeds from a false perception of the overall situation and developments on the front line. Our president outlined the real situation on the battlefield, where the Russian armed forces are confidently advancing, liberating one settlement after another. The establishment of control over one of the Ukrainian army's key fortified settlements. Konstantinovka is an important stage in the liberation of the Donetsk People's Republic. No matter how hard Kiev clings to the remaining fortified areas, our army will definitely take them. So this is what Putin and Trump argued about. Trump told Putin, look, can we now move towards a settlement? Perhaps Trump expected Putin to be more willing to do that, because Trump has been filled with stories about the missile strikes by Ukraine, the drone attacks by Ukraine on Russia. Putin pushed back and said, yes, look, I've never disagreed on principle with the idea of a negotiated resolution of the war, but this must happen on the basis that we in Russia have set out, that I set out at the start of the special military operation, that I set out again in my speech to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June 2024, in other words, Istanbul Plus. And at the moment, we are seeing no sign of that. What we are seeing instead is a drone offensive against us, which is much more part of a psychological psyop than it is anything else, but which operates on the basis of a campaign to terrorize our people, our civilians. And the West is involved in it. And of course, the words which would have been left unsaid is that I know, Donald, that you are involved in it too. And as for this story that the Europeans and Zelensky are spinning about Ukraine having the initiative in the war, that is absolute and complete nonsense, as the fall of Konstantinovka shows. And I get the sense that they went backwards and forwards on this. Trump perhaps expecting that Putin might be more accommodating, might feel himself to be under greater pressure than he is because of the drone attacks. Trump perhaps less willing to hear the news about Konstantinovka and its fall. Trump trying to get Putin to agree to receive Witkoff and Kushner in Moscow. Putin, for his part, very unwilling to receive them. His special envoys, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, will carry on their mediation efforts and are ready to come to Moscow at our convenience. So it is the Russians, we are now told, clearly and for the first time, who are saying they don't want them. So I suspect a difficult conversation overall. And, well, they did discuss other things. We're told that Vladimir Putin expressed hope that the negotiation process based on the MOU between the United States and Iran will help find mutually acceptable long-term solutions to the key aspects of the settlement. We, that is to say the Russians, have confirmed our readiness to provide practical assistance with the de-escalation and destabilization efforts. Donald Trump thanked Russia for its balanced stance and constructive approach. Then there was some discussion of bilateral issues and prospects for future economic cooperation. But Trump, we're told, stressed that for these prospects to be realized, it is necessary to put a stop to the Ukrainian conflict as soon as possible, which all but confirms that American offers of economic assistance are essentially bribes to try to get the Russians to stop the SMO, bribes which the Russians, to Trump's frustration, are not picking up on. And then there was some talk about a joint Russian-US space launch, and about Trump's admiration of the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. And Putin reminded Trump that he has an outstanding invitation to visit Russia. So clearly at the end, there was an attempt to patch things up. But overall, I would say that this was a contentious call. Now, the big question is, will Trump learn anything from this call? Is he able to do so? If Trump has staked everything on an intensified drone and missile offensive on Russia in order to get the Russians to make concessions, the conversation with Putin ought to have disabused him. And we do get from time to time signs of deep frustration in the United States amongst the Americans, amongst the Europeans, about the fact that the Russians don't seem to be at all accommodating to the kind of pressure that people in the West imagined that the West would be able to exert in order to make them change their approach. But there it is. That seems to be what we see. The West continues to try to find some means to escalate and to put pressure on the Russians. But the Russians, Putin showing no sign that they're going to bend to this pressure. Even that Financial Times article that I was speaking about, spoke of, you see some signs in it of frustration that the attempts to pressure Putin and pressure Russia are not working. Putin shows no sign that Ukraine's latest campaigns will force him to the negotiating table. Instead, he has doubled down, insisting that Russia is winning the war and that its military goals are still achievable. His negotiators have told the Americans that it needs to get Kiev to agree to sweeping concessions. Those officials, senior Ukrainian officials involved in the peace negotiations, have told the Financial Times. Those officials said the US brokered trilateral peace talks were unlikely to resume until after the summer. Russia's focus on Putin's maximalist goals means Moscow is unlikely to take part in any meaningful talks before February next year. another person in Moscow involved in back channel talks to end the war said. So there it is. There is still hope in the West that some means can be found to get the Russians, to get Putin to relent, but the Russians are not relenting. And in the meantime, Konstantinovka falls, other places, as I will discuss shortly, also fall or are about to fall. Now, here, perhaps it's worth saying, worth mentioning, that about a week ago, Vladimir Zelensky issued an instruction to the Ukrainian military to undertake a massive 40-day campaign to try to force the Russians to the negotiating table. And again, presumably, that 40-day campaign was this continuation of the drone war. But as I pointed out earlier in the program, the Russians seem to be countering successfully, at least for the moment, the Ukrainian drones. And the 40-day campaign that Zelensky was talking about is not succeeding. It is not causing the damage inside Russia that perhaps he and others in the West might have imagined. So one could see how things are going wrong, at least from a Western point of view. Konstantinovka falls. The Russians continue to advance in Donbass. The situation for the Ukrainian army continues to get more and more critical. And the great drone offensive that everybody expected, probably Donald Trump expected, would bring the Russians to heel. It isn't working. Now, I've memories of something like this before. Way back during the Vietnam War, even as the United States was trying to find some way to extricate itself from the Vietnam War, the Americans believed that they could put pressure on the Vietnamese to get the Vietnamese to change their stance, to soften their stance by escalating bombing of North Vietnam and of North Vietnam's capital, Hanoi, specifically, and by trying to persuade North Vietnam's allies, the Soviet Union and China, to put pressure on North Vietnam to make the concessions to the United States that the United States was at that time demanding of North Vietnam. And to American bafflement, and if you read the various reports and memoirs of people like Henry Kissinger, you see this. The bombing didn't seem to be having the kind of effects on the North Vietnamese that the Americans expected. And Kissinger was complaining about the toughness and even callousness of the North Vietnamese negotiators and all of the attempts to try to get North Vietnam's allies to cut off its aid. None of that worked either. And, well, you see the Americans, in effect, trying the same approach. A drone offensive against Russia, which is, to say it simply, far less powerful than the American bombing campaigns of North Vietnam and an attempt every so often by the United States to try to get Russia's allies, China, India, and the others, to cut it off or to put pressure on it to make big concessions, which never works either. And you do see, as you see in this Financial Times article, the signs of frustration that this pressure doesn't seem to work. In reality, as I have said already, in many programs, and as I think more observers of the war are starting to understand, the drone attacks about which the West has staked so much are proving far less effective inside Russia than perhaps the West and the Ukrainians like to believe. Anyway, I've discussed all of this conversation at some length. Let's turn quickly to the situation on the front lines. The Russians are not only saying that they've captured Konstantinivka, but they also are now saying that their advanced forces are pushing into Druzhivka, the next town immediately to the north of Konstantinivka. And, well, it looks as if the battle for Druzhivka has also begun. And the Russians are also now giving further hints that the Battle of Liman is in effect ended too. There's some suggestions that the Russians are holding back the announcement of the fall of Liman for the first day of the NATO summit meeting in Ankara on the 7th of July, possibly. And, well, the Russians also claimed yesterday that they had captured six settlements, one of which was Konstantinivka, on the same day. And looking at the places where most of these settlements were, most of them appeared to be in Kharkiv region. And there's suggestions that the Ukrainian salient on the east bank of the Oskol near the contested town of Barovaya is about to collapse. And, well, this morning, Group of Forces North formally said that their forces, their advanced forces, have broken in to the important town of Belikolodyaz, in Kharkiv region, and that fighting is now actually taking place there. The capture of this town apparently opening up the way for the fall of the entirety of northeastern Kharkiv under Russian control to take place. And, well, there's apparently also been further reports from Sumy region about which I am less informed. The fighting in and around and south of the village of Barovaya, on the east bank of the Oskol, is important because, as I've discussed in previous programs, if the Russians clear completely the east bank of the Oskol, which they will, then that puts them in a strong position to begin an attack on the town of Izium in southern Kharkiv region. Izium having been under Russian control for a certain period in 2022. Its recapture coming soon after the fall of Konstantinovka and Liman and other places like Raya Alexandrovka and Malinovka, the fall of Izium would definitely mean an encirclement of Ukrainian troops if they were still attempting to defend in Donbass, just say. And on this topic, there's apparently also been significant activity, at least according to Marat Khairulin, in the Dobropilia area as well, to the west of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And by the way, Khairulin has categorically said that the town of Rodinska is indeed under complete Russian control. This has been denied by some people on the Ukrainian side. I consider Khairulin definitive on these matters, just to say. And in Zaporozhye region, I suspect lots of things are also happening. But, well, I have lost track a little about what is happening in Zaporozhye region. But I gather that there are now again claims that fighting is actually taking place within Orekhov itself. But as I said, I'm not up to date with the situation there. So, the West has staked on this big drone offensive against the Russians. The Russians seem to have blunted the drone offensive, which doesn't seem to have been that effective in the first place. The West perhaps doesn't want to acknowledge this. The Russians continue to break through in Donbass. The West is unable to accept this either. We've had these fantastic articles appearing in the Financial Times and in other places denying this reality. Well, you can deny reality, you can deny events on the ground for quite a long time, actually. But eventually, reality has a way of catching up with you. The Russians, Putin, clearly now refusing to receive Witkoff and Kushner, and to resume negotiations for what is clearly still a Western demand for an unconditional ceasefire. And, well, the West about to give Ukraine another $70 billion or euros, none of which is changing the situation on the front lines or in the sky or making the condition of the Ukrainian economy any better. I think that when the history of this conflict is eventually written, it will become increasingly clear that the events of the last few months will have been decisive in not only preventing any possibility of a negotiated resolution of the conflict, but instead of setting the scene for a catastrophic defeat for the West. Anyway, that's my assessment of the situation overall. Let's now look at other things. There has been extraordinary scenes in Iran of the burial of the supreme leader. The funeral ceremony continues to take place. Apparently, it is going to be extended for several days. I've spoken about a Western propensity for denial. I saw again in the British media a rather desperate attempt in one media outlet to say that we should not believe these pictures, these films of hundreds of thousands, millions of people coming to pay their respects to the late murdered, killed supreme leader. The reality is that the political system in Iran continues to be massively unpopular. The protests in Iran in January are supposedly proof of this. No doubt there is considerable opposition to the political system within Iran, but it's always seemed to me that a critical mass of the people continue to support the current system, and the evidence of the funeral confirms it. There has still, however, been no sign of the new supreme leader, Mujtada Khamenei, and my speculations of a few days ago that Dmitry Medvedev, the vice chairman of Russia's Security Council, who is representing Russia at this funeral, my speculations that he might meet Mujtada Khamenei have so far not been realised. Just saying. Anyway, what I found much more interesting are some reports that have been appearing in the United States that over the course of the meeting between the US and Iranian officials in Pakistan, the meeting between J.D. Vance, Witkoff and Kushner on the one side, this is in Islamabad, and Ghalibaf and Araghchi on the other, that there was an actual Israeli plan to assassinate the Iranian negotiators, and that the United States had to take action to prevent this from happening. And according to these reports, the attack was supposed to take the form of Israeli fighter jets intercepting and killing the aircraft, the Iranian aircraft that was carrying the Iranian negotiators. Now, I don't know whether these reports are true, and a lot about this story seems to be very garbled. But I have to say, given the stories, the history of Israeli assassinations, I find it extremely plausible. And it does seem to me that if this did indeed happen, the United States government should tell us so and make clear its very strong disapproval of what the Israelis tried to do. Alternatively, if nothing like this happened, there ought to be a comprehensive, thorough and convincing denial, which up to now I have never seen. Now, there is disagreement within Iran about the MOU and about the wisdom of agreeing with the United States, the MOU. I think it's gradually become clearer over the last couple of days that Iran's control of the Strait of Hormuz continues to be very tight, and that fewer ships carrying oil, far fewer ships carrying oil, are passing through the Strait of Hormuz than was the case in any normal day before the joint American-Israeli attack on Iran on the 28th of February of this year. And there are also reports, and in fact, good reason to believe, that by far the greater part of the oil that is transiting the Strait of Hormuz is going to China and perhaps India. Two countries which historically have been friendly to Iran, though Prime Minister Modi has recently gone out of his way in ways that have gone down badly in Iran to show India's current friendship with Israel. Anyway, if this is true, then it could be that the clock, in terms of oil reserves, is still ticking. That certainly appears to be the view of Larry Johnson, who has been keeping a very, very close watch on these events and who has written about them in detail, as you can read on his Substack site, Sonar 21. And a fact which seems to me to lend some credence to what Larry Johnson is saying is that it appears that the United States is continuing to draw down from its oil reserves. I expected that after the signature of the MOU and with the partial reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, the United States would stop drawing down on its oil reserve, which President Trump himself has admitted is critically depleted. On the contrary, I thought that the United States would be seeking to replenish it. But that doesn't appear to be happening. Instead of replenishing the reserve, they are still drawing down on it. Now, if so, if all of this is true, then this cannot last very long. At some point, maybe rather later than appeared to be the case before the MOU was signed, but probably at some point this year, we are indeed going to get an oil shortage and probably a spike, a big spike in the price of oil. Maybe what is happening will prevent that happening before the midterms, and that might be what the current White House game plan actually is. But we will get a spike in oil prices, and we're going to get a big spike in energy prices altogether. I said in a recent program that natural gas reserves in Europe are low, very low, worse than was the case in 2021, apparently lower than they have been since 2015. And I was reading today that Ukraine has only stored around half the natural gas it would ex be expected to store by this time in the year, and looks like it's going to be critically short of natural gas in the winter, and this, of course, doesn't allow for the renewed Russian attacks and strikes on Ukraine's energy facilities during the winter. If, of course, there are shortages of natural gas in Ukraine, given that there appear to be shortages of natural gas in Europe too, the reverse flow, in other words, the supply of natural gas by Europe to Ukraine might not be sustainable, in which case the situation for Ukraine over the course of the winter is going to be perhaps the most difficult in the war up till now. There have been suggestions that Zelensky's anxiety to bring about an end to the war this summer and autumn is because he fears that Ukraine could find itself in the worst ever energy crisis this winter, unless there is some kind of ceasefire. That might explain many of his moves, his political and diplomatic moves, and perhaps it also explains why he has been so keen to try to get the West to believe that his drone offensive is succeeding and that his soldiers are holding their positions on the front lines. He wants, in other words, the West to redouble its pressure on the Russians to stop. If so, this is a hopeless game. The Russians are very well informed about that, I have no doubt, about the energy situation in Ukraine and in Europe altogether. The pressure on them is nowhere near as great as many people in the West appear to think. The pressure on the West has been immensely underestimated. It could be that with Donbass falling over the course of the autumn and with energy shocks rippling across Ukraine and indeed Europe this winter, and with the Oreshnik probably coming into active service, the picture in a few months is going to look very grim indeed. I repeat my point that these last few months could very well come to be seen, looking back, as the months in which the West threw away its last opportunity to end the war in Ukraine in a face-saving way. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.